psychological cushion of warmth to soothe the soul in seasons of pain. Bottom line, what we need is a God who will not apologize for his sovereignty. A God whose legs do not buckle underneath the crushing weight of evil and sin. We need a God who's willing to look us in the eye and say to our face that all the earth-shaking forces unleashed on the world are unleashed by him. We need a God before whom the precious free will of man is but a house of cards next to his sovereign omnipotence. And my point is, this is the God of Isaiah chapter 45. And my fear, beloved, my fear is that the God of American Christianity that so many people have inherited, that might not be God enough to stand up to the terrors of the 21st century. John Piper puts it this way. He says, our vision of God in relation to evil and suffering has shown to be frivolous. The church has not been spending its energy to go deep with the unfathomable God of the Bible. Against the overwhelming weight and seriousness of the Bible, much of the church is choosing at this very moment to become more light and shallow and entertainment-oriented and therefore irrelevant in its answers for suffering and evil. The popular God of fun church is just too small to hold a hurricane in his hand. The biblical categories of the sovereignty of God lie like landmines, he says, in the pages of the Bible, waiting for someone to seriously open the book. And though those landmines do not kill, they do destroy trivial notions of the Almighty. That's one way to put it. Another way to put it is that the deepest of truths are for the darkest of times. And that's exactly what we have before us in Isaiah 45. I mean, if there were any chapters of the Bible that could explode trivial notions of the Almighty, this is it. I mean, if there is such a thing as a landmine in the Bible, it is Isaiah 45, and in particular, verse 7, in which God declares, I am the one who forms light and creates darkness. I am the one who makes peace, and I am the one who creates evil. I, Yahweh, am the one who does all these things. That's what the text says. I am the one who creates evil. What does that even mean? How could God say that? To hurting people, no less, that he is the one who creates evil? Because that is what the word means. That word means evil. How can this be? Why would you say that? And furthermore, how does that even help them in their situation? I mean, clearly God made a mistake here, and he meant that the devil, oh, you know what? I meant the devil is the one who creates evil, not me. Whoops, my mistake. And yet the text is clear and undeniable. God is the one who does that. And I know that sounds crazy, and that seems like it's impossible, but it's not impossible. And why God even says it at all is because the deepest of truths are for the darkest of times. And if there was any time that was dark and dismal for the people of God, it was the very moment that they were in. I mean, you understand, it was not like Charles Dickens, well, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. No, it was only the worst of times. It was an epoch of sadness, a season of darkness. It was a winter of despair. And the reason why is because Isaiah's audience to whom this chapter was addressed was 2,000 miles away in Babylon in exile. They were taken captive, ripped from their homes, hauled to Babylon in shackles and chains, dumped in a slum reserved for the Jews. It was only the worst of times for the people of Israel. And yet, it's in the very worst of times that only the deepest of truths will do. Church, raking is easy, but all you get are leaves. Digging is hard, but that's how you find the diamonds. And oh, what diamonds there are in Isaiah chapter 45. And yet to get them, we got to go deep. Like scary deep. Like there are things that God says about his sovereignty, like what he says in verse 7, for instance, that frankly most people are just not ready to hear. And yet they must hear it, and we must hear it, because what God says about himself are the thoughts about God that we need to think and that we need to prepare us for the storm that is coming and is already here. And so here we go. Here we go this morning. I want you to see from our text four lessons. Four lessons of God's control over nations, kings, history, and evil. That's where we're going. Four lessons of God's control over nations, kings, history, and evil. That's where we're going. And what you're about to see is a prophecy, sermon, oracle thing divided up into three parts. Part one is this. Number one, if you have your notes, it's in there. Part one, the Persian king predestined. The Persian king predestined, whose name is Cyrus. Now, we saw this at the end of last week, didn't we? You remember at the end of chapter 44, a chapter, by the way, designed to purge idolatry out of the lives of God's people. You remember that chapter 44 ends with five demonstrations of the sovereignty of God. Remember that? God is sovereign over creation, over the pagan powers of the world. He's sovereign over the fate of his people. He's sovereign over armies and wars in the world. And he is sovereign over individual lives and the decisions that they make. And one such example of God's ability to do that is in the case of Cyrus. Look at chapter 44, verse 28. He says, God is the one who says to Cyrus, he is my shepherd. And he will fulfill all my good pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you will be built, and the foundation of your palace will be laid. That's a wild verse. If you are a Jew caught in Babylonian exile, that is a crazy verse. Because it means that a man named Cyrus, whoever that is going to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and its temple, which you saw destroyed by the Babylonians. The problem is that nobody at that time had any idea who Cyrus was because he wasn't even born yet. Isaiah is writing this in 701 BC. Cyrus, king of Persia, conquered Babylon in 539 BC. That's 162 years beforehand, which means God is describing the release of his people from an exile that hadn't even happened yet. Do you feel this? Which means, this is the most particular prophecy in the entire Bible because this dude is mentioned by name a full century before he was ever even born. And Isaiah's still not done with this. He's still not done. There's more to say about Cyrus the king and the deeds that he would do for the people of God, or should I say, the deeds he was predestined to do by God. Look at verses 1 through 3. Thus says Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, who I will seize by his hand, to subdue nations before him. I will loosen the loins of kings. I will and doors before him which will not be closed, gates which shall not be closed. I will go before him. Walls I will break down. Doors of bronze I will shatter. Bars of iron I will break in pieces. I will give to you, Cyrus, the treasures of darkness and riches in hidden places, that you may know that I am Yahweh who called you by your name, the God of Israel. That is profoundly theocentric, isn't it? God-centered. I mean, did you notice the sovereign initiative of God in everything Cyrus would do? Notice the text. I will seize him. I will subdue nations. I will loosen the loins of kings. I will go before him. I will shatter doors and gates, and I will give him the treasure that he plunders. I will do these things because he is God, and there is no other. Did you see that there? Which is so ironic. Because in 1879, there was discovered in Babylon one of the most celebrated artifacts of the ancient world called the Cyrus Cylinder. The Cyrus Cylinder. About the size of a Pringles can made from clay, carved onto the cylinder, get this, is the glory and power of Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, and the deeds and achievements of Cyrus, whom he chose. Here is a sample of that cylinder. I can't remember if it's in your notes, either way. Here's what it says. Here's this ancient artifact. Marduk took under his hand Cyrus and called him by his name, proclaiming him aloud for kingship over all. Marduk, the great lord who nurtures his people, saw with pleasure his, Cyrus's, fine deeds and true heart and ordered that he should go to Babylon. And like a friend and companion, Marduk walked at his side. His, Cyrus's, vast troops, whose number, like water in a river, could not be counted. And all the people, nobles and governors, bowed down before him and kissed his feet, rejoicing over his kingship. And then Cyrus speaks, I am Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, the king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters of the world, son of Cambyses, the great king. I collected together all of the people and returned them to their settlements. That's a sample of a 2,500-year-old artifact praising Cyrus for all of his achievements and giving Marduk the glory. Which is interesting, because Isaiah chapter 45 is a 2,700-year-old document predicting the deeds of Cyrus and rightly giving Yahweh the glory. Do you see? It's incredible. It's incredible. And not only that, it's proof. Proof that God is real. Proof that his word is true. Proof that God is in control. And notice the first, the title given by God to this pagan Persian king, verse 1, thus says Yahweh to Cyrus, notice, his anointed one. Literally in the Hebrew, Mashiach, where we get the word Messiah, which is interesting because in chapter 44, 28, he called Cyrus my shepherd, also a title of the Messiah. And then notice verse 1, he goes on to say that he would seize Cyrus by his hand. Do you see that? Which is interesting because that's the very same thing that Yahweh said he would do in chapter 42 to the Messiah. Do you see what's being shaped here? The question is, why would Yahweh use such explicitly messianic language to refer to this pagan, idolatrous king who, as far as we can tell, never truly trusted Yahweh? Why would he do that? Why would he use elevated messianic language to describe him? That's the question. And the answer is not because Cyrus actually was the Messiah, get this, but that Cyrus the king would be a picture of the Messiah. Do you see? He is a king. He's a shepherd. He's anointed by God, strengthened by God to conquer nations, destroy rival kings, build a kingdom, save the people of God, restore them to their land, rule with power over the nations. Do you see? The resemblance between these two kings is simply uncanny. And the point is, all that Cyrus would do when he arrived on the scene was but a tangible, visible display of what King Jesus will do when he arrives on the scene. And when he does it, he will do it globally and forever. That's the issue. I mean, you see this, right? Cyrus the king was nothing more than a card in Yahweh's deck. And Yahweh was the dealer. And on top of that, the game is rigged. Rigged by sovereignty. Rigged by God's control. Rigged forever. Rigged to put his beauty on display for the joy of his people forever. And you notice, unbeknownst to Cyrus himself, all the things that Yahweh would do in and through this king. Look at verses 1 and 2. I will seize him by his hand, meaning I will lead him to do what I decree. All that I want him to do, he will not fail to do because he is in the grip of my control. And notice, I will subdue nations before him. I will loosen the loins of kings, meaning God ordained that enemy armies wouldn't be able to stand a chance against the battalions of Persia, and they did not stand a chance. That's exactly how history played out. I mean, if you read the history, they walked right into Babylon without even so much as shooting an arrow, and they took control of the entire operation. It's interesting, conquering the world was easy for Persia. It was easy to do. And now we know the reason why. And you see that God would loosen the loins of kings. Do you see that? Which simply means that kings were not prepared for the force of Persia's armies. They were, as it were, caught with their pants down, and they easily caved and surrendered to the legions of Cyrus. I mean, it wasn't even close. It wasn't even close. And now we know the reason why. God was behind the scenes. Do you see? And once upon a time, it was considered chivalrous for men to open the door for ladies. And that's exactly what Yahweh does for Cyrus. He would open doors for him. Gates would not be closed, which is the language of invasion. When you invade and try to conquer a city in the ancient world, you have walls and gates and bars to contend with. The problem is those walls and gates would be heavily guarded, heavily reinforced, designed to resist an enemy attack. And yet when Cyrus showed up, he and his armies walked right through the doors and the gates as if they were already wide open, precisely because Yahweh was the power behind the scenes. Notice verse 2. Yahweh speaks to Cyrus as if he were listening. Look what he says. He says, I will go before you, meaning I'm going to make it easy for you. I'm going to pave the way for you. Verse 2. Debate about this here. I think it's walls. The word is walls there. I will break down walls. Doors of bronze I will shatter, bars of iron I will break in two. Notice again the first person singular verbs. Look at the text. I will make level, I will shatter, I will break. God would do those things, and 120 years later, that is exactly what God did. And verse 3, notice, this is astonishing. Look at the text. The treasures, the plunder, the spoil, and the riches that Cyrus would steal from the other nations. What does Yahweh say? I am the one who gives them to you. I do that. Which means very simply, when Persia marched through the Middle East in 539 BC, crushing enemy armies like insects on the pavement, resulting in a kingdom of 5 million square miles of total domination, unlike anything the world had ever seen at the time. They simply had no idea that God was the secret of their success. And let me be more precise. The sovereignty of God was the secret of their success. Let me just tell you, church, that you should feel profoundly loved by this text. You should read this text and you should feel profoundly loved by God this morning. Do you know why? Because the fact that God talked about Cyrus behind his back before he was born and predetermined all that he would do is a reminder to us that God talked behind our back before the foundation of the world and predetermined the course of our lives also. Think about this here. The name of Cyrus came up in conversation in the secret councils of God, and he was chosen by God to be a king and rule a kingdom. We came up in conversation between the persons of the Trinity before time began. And we weren't just chosen to receive Persia. We were chosen to get it all. My point is very simply this. The concern and vested interest that Yahweh had in Cyrus the king doesn't even begin to compare to the loving interest that Yahweh has in you, whom he gave to his son to purchase with his blood. Don't you see, God is no less sovereign in your lives than he was in Cyrus's life. The difference is, unlike Cyrus, we know him. We know him. We know that he chose us. We know he predestined us. And we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is working all things out for our everlasting good. The deepest of truths for the darkest of times. Part two. Part two, the purpose of the plan. The purpose of the plan for Cyrus, which is God's supremacy. Because that's the question. The question is, why would Yahweh do this? Why would God decree this? This idol-worshipping pagan king to be his chosen instrument to release his people from captivity, send them home, and according to verse 13 in the same chapter, even cover the cost and pay the bill to rebuild the temple and the city. Why this? Does this really bring glory to God? Why not have the Messiah himself do it and just get this thing over with? Or why not resurrect Moses and have him deliver the people? Or resurrect David or Samson or anyone belonging to the people of God? Does this really, really bring God that much glory to pick this guy? Because you would think it would be better to do it another way. But in fact, the exact opposite was the case. Look at verses 3 through 6. And don't miss this, because what you're about to see is at the blazing center of the nature of God and what drives what he does in heaven and on earth. Look at the text. As if talking to Cyrus himself, he says, "Why did I choose you, Cyrus? I'll tell you why. So that you would know that I am Yahweh, the God of Israel who called you by your name." That's why. That's why. The point of picking the king of Persia was so that Cyrus would know that Yahweh is Yahweh. Do you see that in the text? I'm doing this so that you would know that I am Yahweh, meaning that he is not one God among many gods, but that he is the only God there is. He defines what it means to be God. And notice, Yahweh called him by his name before he was born, which means his existence, get this, his existence as a human being was planned and predestined by God himself. The fact that there would be a man on earth named Cyrus was God's idea. I chose your name. I made you exist. I made you a king. I gave you the kingdom that you have. Everything you accomplished was ordained by me. Do you see? It's exactly the same with us. That's what David says in Psalm 139, verse 16. "Your eyes have seen my unformed substance." Get a load of this. "And in your book were written all the days that were ordained for me before there was even one of them." That was true for Cyrus. That was true for David. That's true for you. The book of our days written before the foundation of the world. And so you see, don't you, the purpose of picking Cyrus the king, do you see the purpose? It was the display of God's preeminence. It was so that Cyrus would see the supremacy of Yahweh and be forced to acknowledge that everything he had done and everything that happens in the world, for that matter, is caused and controlled by Yahweh alone. And the question is, of course, is that what you believe? Is that what you believe? Do you view the world and your life through the lenses of meticulous sovereignty? That there are no accidents in the world? Nothing random? Nothing left to chance? Do you see, like Cyrus, that you were called by name, that your name was written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world, and that every moment has been planned and prepared by God before the galaxies were made? Do you believe that? And that doesn't mean we don't make choices, because we do. That doesn't mean we don't make plans, because we do. Nothing changes about our personal responsibility, but the question is, have you learned the lesson that the ultimate answer to everything in life must ultimately terminate in Yahweh? That something is or isn't. That you have or you don't. That something will or will not happen. And all of it is owing to God's decree. That doesn't make us robots, but it does help us worship, and it does help us trust. And the real question is, did Cyrus ever get the message? If this was the experiment, if this was the purpose of choosing Cyrus, that he would be forced to acknowledge the supremacy of Yahweh, did he ever do it is the question. Did he ever come to the realization? In other words, did Cyrus read Isaiah chapter 45? That is the question. And the answer is absolutely he did. He did. And there are two reasons why we know. Number one, the ancient Jewish historian named Josephus confirmed that Cyrus did in fact read Isaiah chapter 45. Historical evidence that he did. Number two, we know Cyrus acknowledged the supremacy and towering majesty of Yahweh because we have his very words in Ezra chapter 1. Did you know that? The words of Cyrus are in the Bible. 160 years after Isaiah wrote this, here's what Cyrus proclaimed to the subjects of his newly acquired kingdom. Here's Ezra 1. Just listen. And in the first year of Cyrus, this is 160 years after Isaiah wrote Isaiah chapter 45. And in the year, first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, to fulfill, here it is, to fulfill the word of Yahweh, Yahweh roused the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he issued a decree in all of his kingdom and even a writing which said, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given to me. He got the message. He understood the message. He read the text. Yahweh won. Yahweh got what he wanted. Mission accomplished. The king acknowledged the supremacy of God over everything he did. And we would do well to follow Cyrus's example, would we not? Because, beloved, what peace we often forfeit, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not see God's supremacy everywhere. And yet God makes clear, hang with me. I know this is heavy theological lifting here. God makes clear that there was another layer to the plan. There was another angle here. God is a God of angles. God has things driving here, multiple layers. There was another angle to this plan beyond the mere choosing of Cyrus, because all Cyrus was a pawn in the game, a means to an end, which we see in verse 4. Look at the text. Yes, I chose you, Cyrus. I called you by name that you would know that I am Yahweh, but why I chose you was not for you, but verse 4, for the sake of my servant Jacob. And Israel, my chosen one, and I will call to you by your name. I will name you with honor, although you have not known me. Do you see that, Cyrus? I didn't do this for you. I did this for them. I did this for my people. For my servant, my people whom I chose, they are the reason I called you by name. They are the reason I gave you your kingdom and everything you own. Do you see God calling this pagan king to do his will and free his people is a shocking illustration to prove that he can and must be trusted. That he is matchless and supreme. That he is lofty and exalted. Infinitely worthy of their worship and allegiance, because as the potter, God reserves the right to do what he pleases with the clay of humanity. And speaking of humanity, that's exactly what we see in verses 5 and 6. Look at the text. You can see that God was not merely after the worship of Israel. He was after the worship of everyone. Look at the text. I am Yahweh. And there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me. Why? So that they will know from the rising of the sun and to its setting that there is no one else besides me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. That just does not get old, does it? To hear God talk that way about himself? That never gets old. And do you know why? It's because that is what we were made for. There are longings and cravings of the soul for glory that only God can fulfill. And notice, as if he were talking to Cyrus in a personal conversation, he says, I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me. Do you see his point? Although Cyrus will not have a clue at first, who God is, or why he had such overwhelming victory over the nations, there is one final explanation. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. That's the reason. And beloved, I just want you to notice there that for the eighth time since chapter 41, God simply declares, I am Yahweh. Do you see that? I am Yahweh. Which by itself, just that phrase, is one of the most staggering theological statements known to man, because Yahweh, you remember, is God's name, right? That's God's name. And his name means something. It's not just syllables. It has a meaning. I've said it before. Built on a present tense verb, the name Yahweh emphasizes his character as eternal and self-existent. His name is a verb. He just is the God who is. It's astonishing. He is the ground of his own existence. God needs nothing but God to be what God is and do what God does, which is why he says, there is no other, which doesn't merely mean there is no other God, which is true, but that Yahweh defines what it means to be God. You understand, don't you? There isn't like some written ideal standard out there in the universe somewhere of what God is and what God should be like, and Yahweh just happens to meet the qualifications. No, Yahweh wrote the qualifications. He defines what it means for God to be God. Which is why he says at the end of verse 5, look at, besides me, there is no God. Which doesn't mean he's lonely. But it does mean he is matchless and incomparable. And church, these realities about God should thrill us to no end, shouldn't they? Because although Cyrus didn't know God, you know God, and that is the most important thing about you. Because we are a people, aren't we? We are a people that we love to name drop, don't we? It's kind of a weird thing, isn't it? We like to name drop. We like to talk about famous people that we know and celebrities that we know and famous people that we've been in contact with. You ever meet someone like that, that every conversation winds up being a story about some famous person that they know, kind of some lofty, elevated person that they've rubbed shoulders with? We do that because we love to feel connected to someone bigger than us, someone more prominent than us. We find our value by who we know. We feed off the fame of other people more accomplished than us. And my point is, if you belong to God through Jesus Christ, you know the only God there is. You know Him. Think about that. You know the only God who has ever existed and the only God who has always existed. You know Him. And not even just know about Him, get this, you are involved, connected to the life of the Trinity through Jesus Christ. You are in the family. You are adopted sons and daughters through the redemption of Jesus Christ. You are heirs of eternal life, citizens of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. In Christ, you have the only God's undivided attention at all times. And you are the object of His divine affection. And that makes our theology so much more meaningful, doesn't it? This isn't theory. This is the most practical thing in the universe. I remember years ago as a new believer reading this big, thick theology book. And I remember it just as clear now as it was then, the statement at the end, in the epilogue, it said, perhaps the greatest tragedy would be that one would be able to delineate orthodox doctrine without having entered into personal fellowship with the one to whom the doctrines testify. And we have that. Personal fellowship with the God who has always existed. Cyrus didn't know God, but you know God. And my question for you is, do you name drop the God of the universe? Not just to unbelievers, to everyone. Do you love to feel connected to the triune God? And even more than that, do you know that you are called to make Him known, not just to drop His name, but to name drop the gospel of Jesus Christ, to spread His fame and proclaim His name and make Him known to those who do not know Him? Did you know that's why you're on the planet? Because the fame of His name and the worship of the nations is exactly what we see. Look at verse 6. I chose you, Cyrus, to fulfill my plan and do my will. Why? Notice very carefully. Why did God do that? So that they would know. Who would know? Those from the rising of the sun to its setting. What would they know? That there is no other besides me. I am Yahweh and there is no other. Do you see what God is unfolding for us? This is now the third and deepest reason why God chose Cyrus. Do you see that? Layer 1, verse 3, I chose you, Cyrus, that you would know. Layer 2, verse 4, I chose Cyrus that Israel would know. Verse 6, layer 3, I chose Cyrus that everyone would know. Do you smell the eschatology here? There's something here where we can see that God is making it clear that the purpose of choosing this pagan king before he was ever born, that the ripple effects of that would be felt even into the future. That one day, nations are going to talk about this. Nations are going to know about this. Nations are going to marvel over God choosing this pagan king, and what will their conclusion be? There is no other but Yahweh. He is Yahweh and there is no other. That's astonishing. And church, my question is, if there's anything that this text makes clear, is it not the passion of God for His own supremacy? Is that not clear? And my question for you is that what you live for? I know that's loaded, and I don't mean to make it feel like I'm cornering you, but is that what you live for? What I mean is God's very goal for history your goal for your own life? Namely, the display and the proclamation of his infinite worth and value and beauty. Is that what drives you? Is that what grips you? Is that what you're living for? Is the goal of your life the same as God's goal for history, namely the display of the weight of his glory and the beauty of his supremacy, which looks like what exactly? What does that even look like to live like that? And I answer with my favorite quote in church history, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. You understand, when you see the glory of God in the beauty of his holiness, only then will you see how hollow the seductions of the world really are. Only when God, listen carefully, only when God is prized in the soul will God be prioritized in your life. Only then will your life be a living sermon that proclaims that Yahweh is God and there is no other. And that, of course, raises one final question. We're pulling on the runway here. All of this talk about the supremacy of God raises the question. The question is, church, what is it about God that makes him so unique? What is it about the character of Yahweh that makes him so matchless and incomparable? That's the question. What makes God so worthy of our attention and interest and worship and admiration? And that brings us to the landmine of verse 7, which most people are not theologically prepared to step on. But we're going to step on it. Part 3, and then we're done. The proof of Yahweh's preeminence. The proof of Yahweh's preeminence, which is his sovereignty. And in particular, church, the sovereignty of God over sin and evil, which God has to talk about. He has to talk about this to show his people what it means for God to be God and why he must be trusted. He has got to open the vault and show us the good stuff. No discount platitudes will do. No dollar store cliches are going to cut it. If we're going to say that God is sovereign and worthy of trust, we have to be willing to say what he says about himself in verse 7. And notice what he says. I alone am God and there is no other. Verse 7, I am the God who forms light and creates darkness. I am the one who makes peace, or maybe your version says well-being, and I am the one who creates evil. I am Yahweh who does all of these things. That right there is the most bold and gutsy explanation of why sin and evil exists in the world, and it came from God's very own mouth. And logically, don't miss this. Theologically, the purpose of verse 7 is clear. What it means for God, to be the unique, matchless Lord of heaven and earth, is that he is the one who forms light and dark and peace and evil. He does that. All of that is under his jurisdiction. If any of those things falls outside of his command, he ceases to be God and worthy of our worship. And notice very carefully. Let's do some exegesis together, shall we? Notice the verse has two pairs. Verse 7 has two pairs, and a pair of statements contain, and each pair of statements contain two objects at the opposite end of the spectrum. Do you see that? Light and dark. Peace and evil. The thing about those two pairs, church, is that grammatically, they are parallel. They're saying the same thing in two different ways. Light and peace are the same and parallel. Darkness and evil are the same and parallel. Which means when God says he forms light and darkness, he's not talking about photon particles versus the absence of photon particles. No. No, light and dark are metaphors, spiritual metaphors for the second set of terms, peace and evil. They are parallel and one of the same. You with me so far? And yet, notice the verbs. Notice the verbs that are there. They are strong. They are active. Nothing is passive. God is the subject performing the action. God forms light. He creates darkness. He makes peace. He creates evil. Notice what verbs are not there. The verbs that we use and prefer: allow and permit and let. Not in the text. And yet, what does it mean? What does it mean when God says he forms light? What does that mean? Well, it means the same as that he is the one who makes peace. Do you see that? Those are parallel. Those are one and the same. And light, you know, is oftentimes a metaphor for salvation and truth and rescue and deliverance, even a synonym for God's glory. Light is a vivid way to describe what life will be like when all things are right. That's the metaphor, and that's exactly what the word peace means. Do you see that? That's the parallel. God makes peace. Maybe your version says shalom, or your version says well-being, but it is the Hebrew word shalom. One of the greatest words in the Hebrew Bible, because what shalom is not a not merely a ceasefire. That is the return of paradise. Shalom describes when God brings all things back to their pristine, pre-fall, paradise-like conditions. It is when God makes all things be the way they ought to be. That is light. That is peace. And that is what God does. That is what it means for God to be God. He does those things. And we say, amen to that. That is what God does. That is what he will do. He is a God of truth and salvation who will bring paradise to earth. And we don't have any problem with that at all. That's what it means for God to be God. And yet for God to be God also means that he controls the other side of the spectrum. God is clear, he forms light, but he also creates darkness. Do you see that? And what does it mean that God creates darkness, except that it also means that he creates evil, because those two phrases are parallel and one and the same. And darkness, you know, is a metaphor in the Bible for judgment, for destruction, perversion, spiritual depression, even the sinful deeds of human beings, which is what the word evil means. God creates evil. That's what the text says. And I know your version says God creates calamity. God creates calamity or some other alternative word. And that's fine. That's just okay. But there, the Hebrew word is the word for evil. It means evil. About half the English versions rightly translate it that way, and the rest chickened out. Soften the blow. They tried to protect you. They didn't think you were able to handle it. And I understand it, but it was misguided. And yet, let's say you prefer the terms calamity, or doom, or disaster, or as one paraphrased version puts it, the bad times. That's fine, that's okay, but no matter how you slice it, at the end of the day, the term includes actual acts of evil and sin. That term is used 347 times in the Hebrew Bible to describe things like invasion, murder, malice, treachery, betrayal, kidnapping, idolatry. This is the word to use to describe the wickedness of Sodom, the sufferings of Job, the adultery of David, and the murder of Uriah. Demonic activity, individual acts of sin. Same Hebrew word here. It is ra. It means evil. And God is the one who creates it. How can that be? What does that even mean? Because I'll have you know, that word there that God uses for creates, God creates darkness, he creates evil. It's the same Hebrew word. It's the same Hebrew word, Genesis 1:1. God created the heavens and the earth. Bara is the term. And that's an incredible choice of word to use, because did you know that there are four other words in Hebrew used to describe create? Four other words you could use to describe creating or making something, and yet why this term matters, why it matters that God chose this term is because, get this, this term is only used of God. This term only occurs with God as the subject, never man. Which means, listen very carefully, God selects the term that makes it evil, makes it clear that evil does not exist outside of his decree. The existence of evil had no ultimate cause outside of God. Satan didn't sneak it in and then God reacted with a backup plan. No. God creates evil in the sense that he decreed it, ordained it, and brought it into being. Through the means of Satan and Adam, yes. He didn't personally do the evil. But brace yourselves. Just as creation itself was God's idea, so sin and evil in creation was also God's idea. That's not saying the same thing as God sins, because he doesn't. It's not the same thing. In no way, shape, or form does God do evil, delight in evil, approve of evil, participate in evil, or minimize evil in any way. That is impossible. Everything you've ever believed about God's holiness and his love and his righteousness is still true. This does not contradict that. The same holy God of chapter 6 is the same holy God who says in Isaiah 45:7 that he creates evil. And what that means, what it means, listen carefully, in some jarring mystery beyond our understanding in this life, is that even sin and evil in the world was caused to exist by the design and the decree of God. He didn't just allow it by some force outside of or unknown to him and then simply make the best of it. No. God, like the architect that he is, drew up the blueprints of history before time. And like an all-wise, all-governing director, all-architect, all-builder, he is building everything exactly as he designed. God, like an all-wise, all-sovereign director, wrote the script of history before time, including the scenes of evil and moments of sin. And like an all-wise, all-sovereign director, he is directing every scene of the script that he wrote. That's what it means for God to be God. And just to make it clear, in case we didn't hear it or we were tempted to disagree with him, look what he says at the end of verse 7. Look what he says. Yahweh am the one who does all of these things. I do them. I do them all. And I know you have questions. And there are answers. And they are coming. Not this sermon. But they are coming. Notice what he says in verse 8. We're almost done. He says, "Drip down, O heavens above. Let the clouds flow with righteousness, and the earth bring forth, and let it spring forth salvation, and let the earth sprout righteousness. I, Yahweh, have created it." I mean, this is interesting, right? This verse gets lost in the shock and the shadow of verse 7, but it shouldn't. Do you see that righteousness is coming to earth? Salvation is coming to the earth. Do you see the connection here? what that verse implies on the heels of verse 7, listen carefully, is that the righteousness that is coming will be all the more glorious because of the darkness that it destroys. The salvation that God brings will be all the more sweet precisely because of the sin that it conquers. The very sin and darkness that God decreed. You have questions. Answers are coming. Next week I'm going to address these questions, at least every one that I can. I'm only going to preach verse 7, and we're going to spend our time in that, talking about what does this mean, how can this be. But until then, let me close with lightning speed with four lessons of God's control over nations, kings, history, and evil, number one. Church, you need to understand that God's control over all is the greatest source of our courage. This is the greatest source of our courage. Courage with the gospel. Courage in an age of hostility. Courage in an age of chaos and terror, courage in the face of evil, courage in the face of persecution, courage when we're tempted with sin, and even courage when we're staring our own mortality right in the face. And the reason why is because no matter what we lose or suffer in this life for the cause of Christ, we know we get it back 10,000 times over in the end. And He rules it all. Number two. God's control is far and away the greatest source of comfort to our souls. This is the greatest comfort to our souls. And the reason why is because, listen very carefully, this is so important. The reason why is because no matter how deep we probe into the motives of God for bringing pain and affliction into our lives, we will never arrive at a layer which was not driven by His love. Does that make sense? No matter how deep you try to probe into the motives of God for bringing pain and affliction into your life, you will never arrive at a layer that was not driven by His love. Yes, pain and affliction come from the throne of God, to be sure, but never, ever forget that it is a throne of grace. Number three, God's control is the greatest source of compassion. It's the greatest source of compassion, and by that I mean compassion for other people. It's not cliche to comfort people with the sovereignty of God. It's not. I mean, we can use it that way, in a cold, unfeeling, insensitive manner. We could do it that way, but that's the wrong way to handle it. That's not what God intended. What I'm saying is God's control, rightly understood and wisely articulated, unleashes compassion for people in pain. The reason why is because God's control is an anchor for storm-tossed souls. It is the confidence that even the worst of miseries will be turned for good when Jesus Christ arrives. Number four, never done. God's control is the greatest source of our captivation. It's the greatest source of our captivation, meaning worship and joy. And delight and pleasure. I want you to feel about sovereignty the way Jonathan Edwards, an 18th century pastor, felt about sovereignty when he said this to his congregation in a sermon. I'll read it and I'll pray. He said, "Absolute sovereignty is what I love to ascribe to God. God's control over all has always appeared to me a great part of His glory and at the center of His beauty. It is at the heart of what makes Him who He is, and it has often been my delight to approach God and adore Him as a sovereign God." Listen to what he says. "And yet it's not as though His sovereignty were different from His love. Because these two perfections are both one and the same and mutually intertwined. The love of God is a sovereign love, and the sovereignty of God is loving in its nature, and thus the sovereign love of God has always been to me a quiet refuge and fountain of delight." And may it be the same. Lord, we kind of feel like Job. We kind of want to just put our hands over our mouths and bury ourselves in the dirt and hesitate to even look towards the heavens, knowing that you are a God intolerably vast and majestic. And your ways are certainly not our ways. We don't understand how you can ordain that evil exist, and it'd be glorious for you to do so. We don't understand all of that, and yet we trust you to be God. We trust you to do what you do, and knowing that we're just people and we don't see the full picture, and that is okay and that is good for us. Well, Lord, help us to not be defensive. Help us to not be reactive. Help us to yield in sweet submission to your word this morning. And you would help us, even though there's so many questions we have, so many things we do not and probably cannot understand in this life, oh Lord, help us. Help us, oh Lord, to be a people who trust. Simple, childlike trust in you, who governs everything that comes to pass, knowing that in the end it will culminate in the kingdom of your Son. And it's in his name that we pray.